I'd heard about prostate cancer. Most men have. I even knew about the heightened risk for black men, which, when adjusted, means that it affects one in three of us. One in three. But this was only meant to happen to old men. Other men. That was until it happened to me. I couldn't make these stories up. These are the stories, the good, the bad, and the unbelievable about my prostate cancer journey. So strap yourself in and let's go. Episode 27, Superpowers, Part 2. In years gone by, prostate cancer treatment was carried out in a variety of hospitals, but it had become clear that those that treated the most cases seemed to have the best results. So the NHS decided to focus treatment in just a few places. The consultant who gave me the news had said that I would be treated at University College Hospital, London, and I would have what was known as a robot-assisted radical prostatectomy. Or in other words, I'd be on the operating table with a four-armed robot while the surgeon sat over the other side of the room at a glorified PlayStation. I went in to meet one of the surgical team, and he went through the procedure. I'd end up with six small scars, I was never going to be able to have children, and depending on how things went, I'd be incontinent for somewhere between a few months to a year, or if I was really unlucky, for the rest of my life, and I'd have erectile dysfunction. The scars I could live with, I didn't want children, and given the choice between having to wear an incontinence pad or dying of cancer, I'll take the tenor lady every time. As for the erectile dysfunction, well, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. The surgeon asked if I had any questions. I think I did. I can't honestly remember. And then he asked if I was happy to proceed. I was, and I signed a consent form. This was early September. How long would I wait for a date, I asked, thinking it would be sometime in February or March, and wondering whether or not I'd be mobile for my birthday. Oh, about 5 weeks, said the surgeon. Now, are you free this afternoon? You should go to surgical school. My boss had said to me to take whatever time I needed, so yes, I was free. Surgical school turned out to be a class of about 20 of us. We had a wide range of ages and a variety of ethnic backgrounds. The one thing we all had in common was that we had this small, walnut-sized gland that was trying to kill us. A pair of very jolly specialist nurses spent 2 hours explaining everything. What we needed to do before the operation, what would happen during the operation, what we'd feel like when we woke up, what we'd need to do straight away, what we'd need to do in the following weeks, what we needed to eat, drink, wear, and they introduced us to the catheter we'd be wearing post-op. Every question we had, they answered. They gave us exercises to do, they gave us lots of things to think about, but mainly they gave us things to read. Lots of things to read. I came home and talked it over with my wife. I knew they'd like to get on with these things, but I wasn't expecting it in a couple of weeks. I explained to my boss, plus one or two close friends, what was going on. But other than that, I kept it quiet. My team at work clearly knew something was up, as I'd started taking days off at very short notice. But now I came clean and explained the situation. I'd be taking a month off work, post-op, so they really ought to know why. The other person I spoke to was a dear friend from work. We'd known each other for about 20 years, and she'd been through the female equivalent of what I was facing. She gave me a lot of useful insight, particularly when it came to how your nearest and dearest might react. It's frustrating for them, she said, because there's nothing they can do. You feel in control as things are explained to you. You have all the information. They just look on from the sidelines and can't do much, and that can cause friction. It was true. My wife and I sometimes didn't see eye to eye. I felt reasonably calm about the situation. I was taking the view that this seemed to have been caught reasonably early, and I was fortunate that I was being treated by some of the best people in the country. And I just couldn't see the point of worrying too much. My wife did worry, though. On reflection, I probably didn't deal with this very well, brushing off her concerns. If I wasn't worried, why was she? It wasn't my finest hour. A couple of weeks later, I was called back into UCLH. I'd assumed this was what the nurse had referred to as my pre-op assessment. However, it wasn't. There were a team of six surgeons at the hospital who carried out this particular procedure, and a surgeon who'd met me earlier had identified me as a candidate for an alternative procedure. In other words, a guinea pig. I now met the surgeon who was going to carry out my op, and he explained to me that as I was relatively young and fairly fit and healthy, I was a suitable candidate for this alternative. Normally, he said, we'd carry out the op that was explained to you. However, a couple of Italians have come up with a variation. It takes a bit longer and it's a bit more complicated. But if it works, then the likelihood of you suffering incontinence is much reduced. Sounded good. Was there a downside though? Well, he said, I'm the only one of the six in this hospital trained to carry out this variation. I've carried out the regular operation about 950 times. And how many times have you done the new way? I asked. Eight. I mulled it over for a few minutes and eventually came to a decision. Doctors learn by doing. Clearly, not everybody was suitable for this procedure, so his opportunities for doing it were very much reduced. Sign me up, I said. Here we have urologist Mr. Philip Charlesworth of London, Harley Street, explaining what the retsius sparing technique actually is.
In a traditional robotic surgical removal of the prostate, the approach that we've used for many, many years, the instruments come in at quite a wide angle, and the bladder and the front of the prostate are approached. And that includes the supporting structures for the continence structure. The bladder supports play a role, the ligaments on top of the prostate play a role. Now, retsius sparing is about sparing that area. That is called the space of retsius. And if you spare that, you spare having to divide the supporting structures for the continence, for the sphincters, for the ability to then get early recovery of your continence after you've had your prostate removed. So the way that we do that is that we come underneath the prostate to start with. We come and take the prostate off the rectum. We define where the erectile nerves are, and we define where the prostate is, and then we work our way up and round, just shelling the prostate out and taking the cancer out, leaving all those important structures on top of the prostate and on top of the sphincter intact, so that when you recover, and when a few days later and the catheter comes out, many patients nowadays, and many of my patients and patients that have retsius sparing, get very little in the way of incontinence, very little in the way of leakage, hardly have to use any pads, and are often massively surprised about how quickly that is. Now, clearly there will still be some patients that will struggle and need some rehab and need some support, but actually when you look at the population of patients that are having retsius sparing compared to having an anterior approach, and this has been proved on randomized control trials, and we're just about to start another one to prove it still further, is that the patients do better and they get their continence back earlier. And I think that's really important. It's something I'm so passionate about because it matters. And these chaps, the patients I operate on, they want that. They want to get their lives back. They want to get back to work. They want to get back to their exercise and their sport. They want to get back on their bikes or go running. And the drier you are, the more control you have, then the happier you are. And that's got to be good.
The next few weeks seemed to fly by. Within 2 weeks, I'd been sent a date for mid-October. I'd made arrangements for people to pick up my workload. I bought a baggy pair of tracksuit bottoms that would be comfortable to wear and would have room for my catheter. I'd been doing my pelvic floor exercises for weeks, and at the request of my surgeon, I tried to lose as much weight as I could in 5 weeks, so he wouldn't have as much to cut through. We caught a taxi up to the hospital. Because my surgeon carried out a list there once a week, I'd been moved to the Princess Gate Hospital in Marylebone, which was posher than most hotels I've ever stayed in. I was shown up to a private room, private room, you know. And there we sat and waited. I can't remember how long we sat there. Somewhere between 2 and 4 hours, I think. Then a nurse came into the room to walk me down to the theatre. We walked into the prep room. I hopped up on the trolley and the anaesthetist introduced himself. I was quite looking forward to this bit. I'd never had an operation before, and lots of people had described the deliciously woozy feeling you get when they give you the pre-med. You try and count back from 10, and it all goes a bit swimmy and you fade out. I don't know what they gave me, but they put a cannula in the back of my hand, and for a split second, I was back in my room being shifted from the trolley to my bed. No hallucinogenic trip for me. It was like someone had flicked a switch, and I lost about 5 hours. This must be what those Texans who get abducted by aliens feel like. Recovery was slower than expected. They'd been hoping to throw me out the next morning, but for a while my blood pressure was low enough to cause concern. But by early afternoon, I'd improved enough to make the senior registrar happy. A nurse had shown me how to use the catheter that had been fitted while I was unconscious. And I'd been given some tablets and some anti-clotting injections. And before I knew it, we were on our way home in a taxi. The next few weeks passed by quite quickly. For a week, I didn't move much, sitting propped up in bed reading. Then I was getting up and moving around. Soon I could go out for short walks. And in less than 2 weeks, I'd been called back to have my catheter removed. While it was a relief in some ways, I'd quite got used to thinking, I need a pee. Oh, right, no need to get up. The worst bit was the anti-clotting jabs. I had 28 needles with the correct dose of anti-clotting agent. You need to squeeze your fibre between your thumb and finger, stick the needle in, inject the fluid, and that was that. After a fortnight, I felt like a bin cushion. After 3 weeks, I was beginning to think that I ought to get back to work. But while I might have looked all right on the outside, I wanted to give my insides as much chance of healing properly as possible. So bravely, I stayed at home and watched daytime TV, as you do. One thing I noticed, though, and reported to the nurse when she phoned for a progress update, was that while I'd worn an incontinence pad for a couple of days, I found that I didn't need to. I'd kept up my pelvic floor exercises, and that, combined with the skill of my surgeon and those two unnamed Italians, seemed to have given me the best possible result. So thank you, doctor, and thank you, unknown Italians. That was nearly 18 months ago. Since then, I've had blood tests every 3 months, which have thankfully been clear. Those tests will carry on for the next 10 years with decreasing regularity. That's as long as they stay clear. I do have to take a variety of tablets every day for the erectile dysfunction, the cholesterol, and the diabetes, but I'm working on losing weight. It's been suggested that I was borderline with the diabetes, so shift a stone or five, and I could be off the tablets. Having been so fortunate with the cancer, so lucky that it was picked up and treated so fast, it seems foolish not to give my health the best possible chance. Yeah, I still have a bit of chocolate now and then, but not as much as I used to. Trust me. I hardly touch fizzy drinks these days. And I get a bit more exercise than I used to. Now, I'm not going to be challenging the Great Britain Olympic team anytime soon, but gradually I'm getting into shape. I was given a second chance that my dad never had, and I'm not going to throw it away. Postscript. After reading this, Peter asked me what I wanted other people to take away from it. And I've been thinking about that for a few days. First off, take care of yourself. Whatever your age and whatever your lifestyle, there are bound to be some simple choices that you can make to tip the odds just a little further in your favour. Just make some changes to your diet. Lose a bit of weight. Get a bit more exercise. It might not prevent you or your loved one from getting prostate cancer, but then again, it just can't do any harm. Second, if you're in a group that are prone to prostate cancer, be that because of your race, your weight, your age, or any combination of those factors, then just get it checked. you might have to push a bit. You might have to be a bit awkward, a bit forward. Make a nuisance of yourself with your GP. But this is your health you're talking about. You don't need to be rude. Just be firm. And lastly, if you do find yourself sitting down with a doctor who gives you the serious look, followed by the news that you didn't want to hear, remember, you're not alone. There'll always be somebody, a wife, a partner, a friend, maybe a colleague, someone who can and will help you. Maybe they'll give you advice, maybe support. Maybe they'll be just someone who'll listen to you while you're worrying. Don't take that help for granted. Most of the time, unsurprisingly, be focused on yourself. But if they care about you, they'll be worrying too. They won't want to put that burden on you, but they're going through it with you, every step of the way. Be grateful. And if you're currently in a battle with that killer walnut, I wish you the very best. This is Dennis signing out.